So welcome to our lecture on the history of the internet. This is our respite from programming like crazy. Again, this was the basis of my Coursera course, and these slides and the audio that we're listening to are copyright Creative Commons. So basically, the internet really came out of the electronic communications came out of the fact that we started making computers. And it's almost like, almost from the moment we built computers, we were going to have created more information and the need to move information around, need for people to connect to information, people connect to technology. In a sense, at the moment of the creation of the first digital electronic computer, the school, the destiny that we would have a school of information, that we would be interested in connecting people, information, and technology in more interesting ways, it was almost like it's only a matter of time. Because as soon as you start having these things that are powerful, that can do things on behalf of us and manipulate information on behalf of us, it's like somebody's got to figure that problem out. And really we've been spending since sort of 1940 to today grappling with this fact that these gadgets that we carry around and connect can do things if we can figure out what it is we want to do with them. So we'll talk a little bit about the dawn of electronic computing, how communication happened before the internet came through, early research networks like the ARPANET, and then the first real internet that was broader than just computer scientists, and then the World Wide Web. A lot of us sort of think of the World Wide Web as the beginning of time, but the World Wide Web will be kind of toward the end of this. So I have some other resources that you can look at. Now here's a video that I've got. It's 25 minutes. I'm not going to show it to you, but I think I'd encourage you to take a look at it on your own. It's a video I made for IEEE Computer Magazine for the 100th, what would be the 100th birthday of Alan Turing. Alan Turing is seen as the father of modern computer science in the 1940s as part of World War II, where they were working to break the German code system. And what they really, what happened was, is the Germans were communicating with Morse code, and because they were using radio and they weren't very sophisticated, everyone could hear the radio waves, and everyone kind of knew what Morse code was. But if you could come up with some kind of cipher where people couldn't understand the Morse, could hear the Morse code, read the letters, but the letters had no meaning, that you have to transform them. So the idea was, in the battlefield, you would have a message, you would transform it, send the transform message, and then untransform the message using secret gadgetry on both ends. And the Germans thought that it was unbreakable because they had this cool gadget called the Enigma that had wheels and electronics and all this cool stuff and key books and all the stuff that you see in movies and scary stuff. And it turns out that literally no security is breakable. The only question is how hard it is to break it. And the people in Britain and the United States, but Britain was really the leading organization, inspired by folks in Poland, which did some of the initial breakthrough work, created these devices that would guess, just by repeated brute force doing something so many times, they would try to guess the keys. And once they would guess the keys, they could decrypt the entire text for the entire day and literally know what everything was going on. And it got to the point by the end of the war where it was likely that British and US intelligence knew what was going on in the German battlefield before some of the German command did, because they were so effective. But they were building gadgets that originally were mechanical, and then they had to create electronic computers because the cryptography kept getting more and more difficult and the mechanical computers couldn't keep up, and so they just were forced to build electronic computers, and then it sort of exploded after that. And so it's a really cool little thing. It's 25 minutes. I won't have you watch it right now. We don't have the time, but I encourage you to watch it. It sort of is the context for all this. Now what happened was is they'd created the world's first electronic general purpose computer in top secret. But all of these scientists who'd done this from mostly Cambridge, at Bletchley Park, north of London, they actually knew how to do it, but they couldn't talk about what they did, but they all went immediately to places like Harvard, Manchester in the UK, University College London, MIT, and they immediately started building electronic digital computers using all the clever techniques, but they couldn't like tell people where they came from, they just knew how to build them. And so in the 1940s, there was all these really cool computers. And they were building them in academia rather than building them for a war effort, so they could take a little more time and make them more flexible, whereas in the war effort, they made them more single purpose. And so this is where everyone argues about who built the first electronic digital computer, and you know, Manchester, United States, and everyone was doing it at the same time because everybody kind of was part of this wartime effort and they knew all the tricks and they were just like soldering as fast as they could to make these things. So it sort of blossomed in the post-war. And one of the things that happened at the end of World War II, and I want to explore this some more, that one of the things that happened at the end of World War II is that it was the first war where the belief was that the generals could never have won the war without scientists, right? So it's the first war that science, technology, mathematics, was seen to be the reason. The winning side was the side that had the best mathematicians. So there was a moment afterwards where the U.S. government were scratching their heads, and that's, we just realized that our generals, with all their medals and all their green uniforms and stuff, aren't the key to future wars. What should we do? And so this is why the National Science Foundation was created, like immediately after World War II, created the National Science Foundation with the idea of dumping money into smart people. And this, it gets to the point where in the 50s, smart people are like athletes. Right? We don't necessarily treat smart people quite like athletes. Google kind of does these days, but the government used to treat smart people like athletes, and their weirdness was tolerated, their misbehaving was tolerated, and the smarter you are, now they didn't care if you were like 98% smart, then you're just kind of somebody else. But if you were like in that like top 2%, you were like an athlete, you were like a football player. And this movie, A Beautiful Mind, if you've seen the movie, I mean, how many people have seen the movie? Yeah, it's a great movie. It's a good tearjerker movie, at least for academics. Beautiful Mind gives a sense of the culture of the time. Let's see if I got. Do I have time for this? I never have time. Do you mind if we just stay till midnight and I can just show you all my best stuff? All my good stuff. Okay, I don't have time to show you all this. I got the movie, I ripped it. So it's this, I guess most of you have seen it, right? It's this moment where it's really, really quite exciting, and the government and everything is looking really, really cool. And John Forbes Nash, of course, is a real person. For those of you who don't know, who've seen the movie Beautiful Mind, he was a genius, one of these people in the 50s, again, just after World War II ended, identified as a genius in high school, dragged to Princeton, you know, given a PhD at 22 years old. He went to MIT as mathematics faculty. He had schizophrenia, rapid onset of schizophrenia. Some claim it was triggered by the fact that like he hadn't won a Nobel Prize by the time he was 30. And this like ticked him off because he was such a genius. So he actually went into horrible sort of schizophrenia and sort of lost track of the world. But the work that he had done, both in his PhD and early work at MIT, really became the foundation for modern economics, game theory, non-cooperative competition, solving the concepts that were unknown for years about why it was that law of supply and demand actually worked. People understood the law of supply and demand from the 1800s, 1700s, 1800s, but they didn't understand why, and John Nash came up with a mathematical proof as to why people didn't necessarily go for each other's throats in every situation. The fact that there was an aspect of cooperation to game theory, and of course we have plenty of game theory classes here, and his friends got together. He kind of, later in life, controlled his schizophrenia just by like force of will in his mind, and you can actually see him talking, the real John Nash. It's really quite inspirational, where he talks about at one point where you know, he'd controlled his schizophrenia, but it was kind of a bummer to have his schizophrenia controlled because his voices were really pretty cool, and they told him the good stuff and they told him the bad stuff, and he was then, and so the voices were what made him brilliant, but they also were what destroyed his life. And then later he controlled it and sort of he lost both sides, right? He lost both sides of it. And his friends in 1994, basically, he'd had all this influential work, and in 1994 he was given the Nobel Prize in Economics. And so it's a really wonderful story, and both a good movie, and there's a PBS special if you haven't seen it, most of which is available on YouTube. And it's really wonderful to watch the movie by Ron Howard and then watch the also watch the real thing and how they're similar and different. So in this time, the way that people connected computers together was through what's called phone line networking. And we didn't have an internet, we didn't have wireless, we didn't have anything. We had a telephone system. And even in World War II, when they were connecting and sending messages, they would have a leased line, a piece of copper that would go in the ground. And we would use dial-up connections where we would turn our data into sound to make connections to our computers, because each campus would have one computer, and then we'd have these things called terminals spread around the campus. And we would dial up. Sometimes we would dial long distance. That would be very expensive. And then sometimes we would connect two computers together with an even more expensive thing called a leased line. A leased line is where you would go to the phone company and you'd say, make me a permanent connection between here and Chelsea. And the cost of these leased lines had to do with the distance, because you were basically taking limited resource in the ground of copper wire in the ground that the phone company had carefully dug a hole and buried a certain number of copper wires. And then when you would make a call, you'd use the copper wire temporarily, then you'd hang up. But if you were leasing the line, you were going to use that copper wire 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so they charged you ferociously for the use of these leased lines. And so let me show you a real brief video about what life was like back then. Hang on. Where's that one at? There it is. Okay, so what this, so, well, we're going to see how in the 60s we connected here at the University of Michigan campus to computers. Oh wait, that's,
the Michigan Terminal System, a large computing system at the University of Michigan Computing Center, using the IBM Model 36067. We will be using a standard teletype. We will be dialing in through the ordinary university-centric telephone system. This system can be used by a telephone system anywhere in the world, as long as we can dial directly into the computer. These teletypes are not wired in, but use the ordinary telephone system. We start by pushing the originate button, which turns on the teletype. Then we will dial using the regular telephone dial here. Now, there is a handset which is available with every teletype system. You can dial this number if you like with the handset. Either one works. But as soon as you are connected to the computer, do not use the handset for any purpose at all. Now I'll push the originate button. I can control the speaker volume with this little knob, and so you can hear it. Now I will dial the number, 763-0300, or in the Centrex system, just 30300. And now the computer is coming in. I will turn the volume down. The response from the computer is the identification of the system. The who are you is the standard teletype communication identification, and the teletype itself answers with its own built-in code number. In this case, the teletype at the TV center. Now I must sign on to the computer and identify myself. The number sign at the beginning of the line is the indication that the Michigan Terminal System is waiting for me to communicate something to it. The first thing I must do is issue the sign-on command. All commands in the system start with a dollar sign. Now, the keyboard on the teletype is very much like the keyboard of a typewriter, including a shift key for the characters on the top of the key. We do not have upper and lowercase letters, however, so the shift key is only used to get an additional set of characters. And in this case, the dollar sign is the character above the number 4. Now I will use the word sign-on, which is the official command, S-I-G-N-O-N. There must be a space, at least one, after every command. And now I will give my own personal computing center number, which happens to be W010. Each user of the system is issued a computing center identification number, through his instructor, if he's a student, or through the department, for faculty. Now, this line has been typed. It is being held by the computer, but I can, if I see any errors in it, do some editing and correcting. We'll see that later. I am satisfied with this line, and now I will give the end-of-line character, which must be given after every line, and I will remind you each time that I'm doing it for a while. The character for ending the line uses the control key on the keyboard, which is a special key which indicates that I want to use even additional characters besides those that are added by the use of the shift key. I hold the control key down, and while I hold it down, I can hit one of a number of other keys. And in this case, I will use the control with the letter Q. It's possible to use the letter F also, but that's right next to another key which disconnects the teletype, so I recommend using Q. I will use Control and Q to terminate the line. And now I'm asked to give my private password. I'll give an incorrect password with some nonsense characters, and of course, end of line, because I must indicate that I'm satisfied with that. I'm prompted that I better give another password. And now, since I intend to give the correct password, I will turn off the printing so that no one can see what mine is. To turn off printing, we use this switch, which is labeled HDX and FDX for half duplex and full duplex. We normally operate the teletype in half duplex mode. If I push it to full duplex, printing is suppressed. And now I will give my correct password, push the half duplex again, and end of line character, control Q. And it is accepted by the system, and I am now signed on. The information that's coming out here is time and date of the previous sign-on and time and date of this sign-on.
So that goes on for 45 minutes. You can watch the whole thing if you want. It is fascinating. But there are a couple things to note. Why did all the people in the 60s talk that way? They all talked that way, right? They all like, I'm the 1960s boys. It looks kind of like Python, right? Yeah, it's waiting for you, yeah, right? It was like, what do you want to do next, oh master, right? It's kind of not that different. And the thing that I would observe, and I didn't hack on computers till the 70s, but it wasn't by the 70s, it wasn't that different than this. It really wasn't. And what was really interesting is that as slow as that is and as clunky as that is, for me, that's a beautiful sound. It reminds me of my childhood. As slow as that was, it was a wonderfully creative environment. And so I sit here with this iPhone that's more powerful than, you know, locomotives or whatever it is. And I feel creative in front of this and connecting to my colleagues and whatever. But in this world there, even with uppercase and all the weird stuff that you had to do and the clunking and banging, what you really cared about was who it was that you were dealing with or what you were dealing with, the sort of information. It's the mechanism is crude, and it makes a gloriously crude noise, and everything was slow. But still, from the very first moment, it became about people. And all this stuff was really just a vehicle to deal with people, to get to find the people that you cared about. And so, you had one, the long distance phone calls were not free, but short on campus calls were free. And so you would often have two phones in your office. You'd have one to dial up the computer and one to talk to people, because you, as soon as you walked in the morning, you would dial up the computer and you would leave that logged in the whole day, because that's how you would work. But the problem is, of course, is that you can't call long distance and afford to stay logged in all day. I mean, I called from an airplane, I think, in like the 80s, like paid $20 to be logged in for just a minute on an airplane with an early laptop. So there was this need and urge to connect computers together and sort of aggregate the communication so that we could move the communication across. And we would use these leased lines, and they were very expensive. You get this dedicated connection. You were using limited copper connections you were taking something away from the phone company that was a limited resource, so they charged you ferociously for that. It could easily be $10,000 a month for a line from here to Chelsea, right? It could be easily that expensive. And it was always connected, so all the dialing that he was doing, that's not necessary. You'd send data in one end and the data would come out. And it was quite common, and it really happened. And hang on, I better turn off my email. I don't want my email to be popping up. But there were situations where it was really worth it. So you take a bank, for example, and if it's geographically like the city of Ann Arbor with one a central bank and a bunch of branches, and they wanted to send transactions back during the day, it might cost $100,000 a year to have 10 connections within the city. But the fact that the bank balance was updated instantly, that was easily worth $100,000 or $100,000 a month, because you couldn't have a person driving in a car or whatever the alternative. So there were situations where these wires were cost effective. They really weren't cost effective to have a connection from Michigan to Stanford all the time, but they were cost effective to have something within a sort of metropolitan area. And what happened was, is universities, being the kind of filled with the creatures that want to communicate with each other, we started creating kind of bilateral connections between universities. I'll talk in a bit about Michigan State and Wayne State connected each other together, and we could share stuff. It was slow, but we were connected. And so we used a technique called store and forward networking, where we would individually talk to, here on Ann Arbor, we talked to the Michigan computer, and we would like put files or messages in that computer, and then they would queue up and wait to go across the single lease line that we would have. And so we would all be sitting and sending like mail and messages, and they would queue up and have to wait. And these lines were slow, and they just would be like this queue, and a message would start flowing through the line, and it would take some time. It would take absolutely some time, and at some point, that message would be done, and then the next message, say we're the green message, we're still waiting while the orange message is kind of flowing through the line, and we're sitting and waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting, and then finally, it's our turn. And once we're across, we might actually have to go across another link, and then another link, and then all the traffic would come together. And we created these sort of snake-like networks around the country that took sometimes 30 or 40 of these connections, where each of these connections, you had to wait your turn to get out of it, and all the other traffic kind of got in line. You were always in a line. Okay, and so this, but we made these snake-like networks where the whole message had, we would just send a message and we'd wait until it finished, and then we'd send the next message and we'd wait until it finished and send the next message and wait until it finished. Now what, yeah? So it depends. So in those days, and we're getting a little ahead of the slides, in those days, we ended up ultimately quite connected, but with sort of like a long tendril. So to get from here to Stanford, we might go through Princeton, and it might take 8, 10, 12 hops to get to Princeton, and then it might take 15 or 16 hops to get to Stanford. On a good day, if people were behaving, you might get to Stanford in an hour. You might send a 10-line email message that would get to Stanford in an hour. On a bad day, it would take 2 days to get a message to Stanford. So that's the kind of, it all depends, right? Somebody sent a big file and the whole Midwest is clogged up for an hour while that big file's moving. And it got worse rather than better because the distance, so if we have like East Lansing, Ann Arbor, and Cleveland, Case Western Reserve there, the cost is really, the best way to think of these costs is if we're connecting East Lansing and Ann Arbor, we would split the cost 50-50 of the distance of, say, 60 miles. And Michigan and Case Western would split the cost 50-50 of the distance of 100 miles or 120 miles. So there was always this temptation to add more people. And so it was cheaper if we could just get to the point where we could just find a little thing in a corner of Toledo. And then we would split the Toledo to Michigan connection between Toledo and Michigan, and then split the Toledo to Case Western with them. Now we've added all the Toledo people to the network, so our connectivity has grown wonderfully. Our costs are dropping rapidly. That literally, the more you add, the cheaper each line is. But the more traffic you get, right? So the motivation, given that we're universities, and given this quite a bit of money, so it could easily be... So I don't know the exact numbers, but Lou Greenberg, the guy who paid for the connection between East Lansing and Ann Arbor in the 80s, said that instead of buying one 960 character per second line 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, we'd be much better off to buy a Ferrari every year and hire a driver to drive back and forth as fast as possible between Ann Arbor and East Lansing and move data back and forth using a Ferrari rather than, so there was, I think that meant that it was about $100,000 to $120,000 per year in the 80s to have that purple connection between East Lansing. And of course, just to give you a sense of speed, so you have a phone, you have like 12G, and then before that we had 4G, and before that we had 3G. Edge was before 3G, is like no G, and Edge is 128,000 bits per second, which is 12,000 characters per second. So Edge was 12,000 characters per second. That connection in the 80s between Lansing and Ann Arbor was 960. So it's like less than Edge, right? For two whole campuses talking, less than Edge. Yeah, I think it's like, I think it's 10% of Edge. It's 1/10 as fast as Edge. For two campuses, 10% as fast as Edge. Okay, so these hops, we got more of them, but we got more people. So it was cool because we got a lot of people and it wouldn't, and a place like Toledo, poof, they're on the network, right? Because others wanted to use their building, and the way you did it is by bringing them in. So the connectivity was quite snaky, right? So we would, every time you'd add somebody, it would chop the price down quite a bit, but then add more people. But then we're cheap universities, so we didn't necessarily make it that much faster. We would just share it and make our faculty wait longer. So this forward networking could go from 6 hours to 2 days, as I said. You had this one computer, you would sort of send your email to that computer, and it would sit in the computer fighting with all the other incoming and outbound mail to move across those networks. And that was what life was like for academics in the early 80s. And there was a number of these snaky worldwide snaky networks that did this. BitNet was one that we were on early on. Now, interestingly, at the same time, there was a bunch of researchers that were building a very different kind of network. And the basic idea of the network was to solve two problems. One is, we don't want to have to wait. If somebody gets in front of us with a really long file that they want to transfer, we don't want to wait until that file's done. So we want to be able to get in front of long things. So little things should have a fair chance against long things. So you didn't have to just wait. Because in BitNet, you had to wait. Every computer you touched, you ended up in an outbound queue that took a long time. And we didn't want to have direct connections to all the places. We still wanted to have kind of this snaky network. And the more complex it gets, you want to be able to deal with outages. So in the old days, if the connection between Toledo and Case Western Reserve went down, the whole state of Michigan was down. End of story. And there was this group that called ARPANET that was researching this. And so this was something that happened from the late 60s through the mid 70s, where it was the funded by the federal government. And it was a bunch of really bright computer scientists at places like Stanford and UCLA and MIT and all over the country. And what happened was is they were doing research on ways to make better networks. And it was a grant. But it was an ARPA grant. DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And there's NSFNet that gives money to academics, and we go through all these processes by which we ask for money, and then we get peer-reviewed, and then we get a little bit of money, and maybe we don't get a money, and whatever. Well, DARPA funds things really differently. The way DARPA gives money out is popularized in television movies, where there's this guy in a white lab coat, middle-aged guy with a white lab coat, with a beautiful 16-year-old daughter. And the movie starts out, and the wet lab coat guy is slaving in his lab, making microscopic killer death robots or something. And the movie starts by a really nasty, mean-looking guy, a general, coming in with all the medals and saying, your nasty death killer robots are running behind schedule, and I need them tomorrow. And then people start shooting, and people take hostages, and wait a second. Before the people start shooting, the guy from the government says, I have given you millions of dollars, and you are behind schedule on the death robots, and I want my death robots in 1 month, or I'm never giving you another penny. So the faculty members got millions, they got helicopters and boats and stuff. That's kind of how the defense people give money, right? It's a bit of a characterization of it, or a cartoonish version of it, but they would give you a ton of money, or they would get really mad if you didn't do well. So this was a group of people that over a long period of time were allowed to do research, and they were very well funded. So the notion of having a long distance call between MIT in Boston and Stanford in Palo Alto, it's just money. It's the government's money. They'll write us a check, right? So they had a real deep checkbook. They were not constrained, which is how research actually should be, by like little things like how much a phone line costs. They were like, well, let's have a phone line. Let's see what we can do with it. Let's connect all these guys together. And so they were building a shared network, a shared infrastructure. And it got larger and larger, but it was mostly computer science department and Department of Defense folks that were using this. And the basic concept that they invented and then created good technology around was a thing called packet switching. Packet switching is the opposite of store and forward. And the idea is that you take every message and you break it into some fixed size packet. And then for a message to go end to end, it gets sent one packet at a time. But if a bunch of messages are going, then one packet from each message goes, and then the next packet from each message goes. So a short message has an equal chance of making it through for a long message, right? So if there's nothing going on, there's a big long message, the packets run really fast. If all of a sudden, and that's going to take an hour for that to run, your little 20 character email shows up, You just wait a very short period of time, and then your 20 characters goes across, and then the file continues back on, right? I mean, it's kind of like if you're watching YouTube and you get an instant message on your computer, right? I mean, you don't have to wait till the YouTube is done before the instant message pops up. And that's because your network in your home is packet switching, which means that, yeah, there's YouTube, and they do have to wait, but you don't have to wait for the whole YouTube. You have to wait for like a hundredth of a second of the YouTube, and then your instant message comes in. So that's the idea of packets. Now, it turns out that this is rather complex once you start switching from sending the entire message and waiting for the entire message to the point where each little piece goes through, because you got to put addresses on them and all kinds of stuff, and you got to build these things like routers and, you know, who knows what for traffic control. And so here's a kind of an example of a packet example of I'm going to send a note to Glenn, and I want to say hello there, have a nice day. And I'm limited to 10 characters. So think of this as all I've got is a postcard, and I can put 10 characters on. I got to put a to and a from address on every postcard. And then I throw the postcards out into my mailbox, right? That's how it's going to work. So I break my message into three postcards, because each postcard has a maximum number of characters. I address them. I have to put a sequence number on them, 1, 2, 3. So when Glenn gets them, he's going to get them out of his post box. And so I just dump them into my post box. And then magic happens. They end up on cars and trains and donkeys and whatever, you know, and at some point they start appearing in Glenn's mailbox. And so Glenn starts seeing these things. Says, oh, looks like Chuck started a message for me. Here comes part number one. Oops, the other, apparently message two, took like the donkey instead of an airplane. And then later, you know, 2 days later, message two shows up, and now Glenn can reconstruct it. And so this is the notion of breaking something long into a series of short things, adding a little bit of detail to it so that you can actually reconstruct the original message afterwards. In our next lecture, we'll talk a lot more detail about how this works in TCP/IP. And so this is the structure of a shared network. We have this fabric, and these yellow lines are the long distance lines. And there are long snake-like structures that connect, and a message can take multiple hops, just like it did in BitNet. The difference is what's going across is a packet, and they're short, and so the time you wait is rather small. And so we have this sort of cloud-like structure, which is lots of hops still, and lots of equipment, and lots of paths, and lots of complexity, but we get through it a lot faster because nothing is clogged by any single message. Everyone's kind of sharing it. Even though one message is going across at a time, it's a little fraction of every message, so you got your little chance to sneak on the highway and merge on the highway and get across and then get off and get back on the highway. I guess it's kind of like cars on a highway versus trains on a train track. And so packet switching is this concept that is rather complex. And what we'll talk about in the next lecture is the kind of engineering that it took to build such a thing. So here's just an example of a problem. These little routers, they kind of look at your message like a postcard in a mail office, and they go like, oh, this is from Lansing or from Ann Arbor, and it's going to Stanford, and I'm in Kansas City. Which truck do I put it on? And they put it on a truck. Now, sometimes it'll be on the wrong truck. So these poor little post office people in Kansas City, they don't exactly know everything about how the world works, and these routers deep inside the network don't always know as well. And so you can have a situation where your postcard starts going around in circles because some confused people at post office boxes get it. And so there's a real problem in the internet. A piece of data might sort of get misrouted to the point where it ends up in a circle, and if you did that, actually the network would melt really fast. So that's just kind of the technical problems that they had to solve. And so that was a research network that thought through all these problems of how to do messages, break them into packets, how to share such a thing. And that was really done in a computer science department mostly. And so that was just a research project. And people like us were not really destined to see this network. And it turned out that the first group outside the Department of Defense and some computer science departments that wanted to do sort of a really broad network was the National Science Foundation. And what they were doing in the 80s was buying supercomputers for scientists, because we were realizing that science could be advanced by the use of computers and simulations. So all these universities and physicists said, if you give me a $20 million computer, I'll be much faster. I'll do a lot better physics. They realized they couldn't do that to every physicist. And so they said, why don't we build a network for people, physicists, to use one or two computers that we put at one place. So that was the idea of the National Science Foundation's network. And so they awarded like seven supercomputer centers, and then later they awarded a network ostensibly to connect the seven supercomputer centers. So in this video, we're going to meet a fellow named Larry Smarr, who's the director for the National Center for Supercomputing Applications in University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And he'll talk a little bit about how the NSFNet came to be. I taped this in 1997. The internet popped out about 1994. And so this is only 3 years, the web popped out about 1994 from NCSA. And so this is just three short years after the internet kind of became pretty serious business.
I'll show you the burners of the footage. It's it. I have to tell you that I'm a giant fan of yours.
Oh, really?
Yes, I am. I don't know you and I've never met you, but it seems to me as though maybe I'm just, it's just the Larry Smarr image rather than the real Larry Smarr.
You have to tell me what it is. I'm the one person who never gets to see that.
The Larry Smarr image?
Yeah, right.
Oh.
I'm terribly dirty inside.
Yeah. I didn't know you were an astronomer.
Oh, yeah.
You know Bob Stein by any chance?
Sure.
Yeah, Bob Stein is my mentor.
Really? Oh, yeah, we did.
Yeah, I heard he's like in top five here. Bob is the guy that taught me high performance computing.
I know exactly.
And
Rob Wolf used to be a good friend of ours before he had his stroke.
Yeah. And but I mean, to me, after
it's gonna get disrupted. Why don't you take this over there? Tell Jerry I hold my calls. So why has Ronner got into this?
Yeah, go ahead, Mike. Okay. Tell me how the NCSA started. I mean, the whole purpose of this is sort of about NCSA. It's not as much about Netscape and Mosaic. I mean, to me, I'm curious if I can tell you guys about why it happened here.
Right.
Which is,
I can tell you about that. Okay.
Go ahead, tell me about NCSA.
Okay. Does a little red light go on when you're...
Yep, I'm recording.
Okay, good. Well, I am a trained relativistic astrophysicist, and I got my PhDs always in physics departments, working on astrophysics problems involving general relativity, gas dynamics, and so forth. And so in the 70s, when I was developing what is now called numerical general relativity, which is the way to solve Einstein's equations for dynamics of black holes, colliding black holes, or in astrophysics that require general relativity, like supernova events and so on, I had to go and get a top secret nuclear weapons clearance to get access to supercomputers, because in the mid-70s, the only place to get a supercomputer was either at the Rua de los Alamos or in one area, which was weather. Now, astronomy has always been a driver of supercomputing, and in fact, on John von Neumann's computer that was built by the Institute, half of that and went to Army to Aberdeen. Half of that was used, of course, for the Army for trajectory calculations, but the other half was used for stellar evolution. So astronomy and von Neumann's interest in weather meant that astronomy and weather for 50 years basically have been dominant drivers of supercomputing usage. And yet, to do pure astrophysics, you're having to get a top secret nuclear weapons clearance. Now, nobody seemed to think there was anything unusual about this. And so I just went ahead as a postdoc, and I would get a few months in the summer, work 100 hours a week, and then the last of the year, I'd have to live off it, right, Harvard, where I was a junior fellow, try to explain to them about, you know, one could solve the laws of physics that we had been laying down for 300 years in incredible detail for engineering devices like nuclear weapons that put on Earth temperatures of the center of the sun, stresses beyond anything that we could imagine in academic problems that we're trying to solve in lots of disciplines. So this thing could revolutionize academic research. Well, nobody got it. It was like, I really felt like I was transitioning in a flying saucer between this advanced civilization at Livermore and this Stone Age culture at Harvard. And Harvard was as advanced as any place in thinking about this. So it was I didn't figure this out until it was in the early 80s. And by then, the first Cray had gone into the continent of Europe at an open scientific institute, the Max Planck Institute of Physics and Astrophysics. So I'm over there in the summer, along with people like Dave Arnett, who is one of the great supernova supercomputer guys in our country, and people in chemistry. And it was like Paris in the 20s with all these expatriates sitting over there. And we're like trying to figure this out. Like, it's an American-built supercomputer, right? Why are we in Munich? Right? I mean, this is very strange. So, but, you know, in America, we don't question the infrastructure somehow. I mean, it's just like it's either there or it isn't there, and that's just the way it is. But I was having a Masa beer late one night. Actually, I think it was the second Masa beer with my German host, who had also been born, like I was, post-war. And he finally turns to me and he says, "Aren't you ashamed of yourself? You big, rich, occupying country, you come over here in our little country, and we finally get enough money scraped together after World War II to buy one of these supercomputers, and you Americans come over here and use up our time." He says, "How did you guys ever win the war? You know, what is going on here?" And so this finally sort of just stimulated me to say, what is going on here? This is nuts. And I went back and I found out, for instance, that after the Sputnik program, the federal government had funded the universities, built the science buildings, started the supercomputer centers. IBM would go around and give away almost the mainframes. And so the scientists in the 60s took it for granted that they had the fastest computers in the world in academia. But about 1970, with the starting of the Vietnam War and with all kinds of guns and butters issues and everything else, that stopped. And in fact, to give you an example, by 78, half the number of PhDs and engineers in engineering was being generated in our country as there were in 1970. So there was this complete severing of the Sputnik era partnership with the federal government. And it was particularly bad in computing. To give you an example, when I was at Livermore, In the 70s, there were four CDC 7600s, which were just one of the finest supercomputers ever built. No American university ever took delivery of a single CDC 7600. In fact, the University of Illinois, when I first got here, had the Cyber 175, which was a retread, a second design manufacturing of this thing. And we were one of the first universities that had it, and people all thought that, you know, Illinois naturally was way ahead of everybody else. So it's like we were just completely divorced from the private sector that was generating these wonderful machines because of federal policy, which was to say, these things are so valuable that we can only afford to put them into war environments. So after this German encounter, I came back and I said, "Well, gee, I wonder how many other scientists like me are there?" So at the University of Illinois, I started cold calling my colleagues and saying, "Hi, you don't know me, I'm a little assistant professor, but I bet you that your research is blocked by lack of access to supercomputers." And they'd sort of say, like, "Who? Crank. Who is this?" You know, crank call. But we'd start talking in chemistry and biology and agriculture and so on, and sure enough, it turns out that was true. They knew how to do the science, they just didn't have access. But they'll send me a little prospectus of what science you could do if you had a supercomputer. Well, I ended up with 65 faculty and 15 departments on one campus. And I thought, this has got to be this way all over the country. So it was, I really started saying, well, gee, somebody's got to raise this issue. And about that time, there had been a lax report that had our government had done to begin to undercover some of this stuff, but they still weren't. I remember Peter Lax, he was one of the greatest mathematicians, head of one of the top people at the Cron Institute, a long-time advocate of things computational. And I had this long battle with Peter, because in the draft report of the LAX report, it was going to say, well, yeah, we got to get one of these supercomputers and make it available to the university, but you know, let's put it in Livermore, put it somewhere that people know how to do this stuff. And a university was not on the list of what the LAX report considered to be appropriate sites for a supercomputer. So I had this long battle over the telephone, I remember, with Peter LAX. It was sort of David and Goliath, because I mean, he was this giant of the field, I'm nobody. And I finally convinced him not to exclude universities as a possibility, even though he felt that it was fairly unlikely that any of them would be able to play with sharp instruments and not hurt themselves. So, I mean, you gotta understand, the world was totally different when the Supercomputer Center's program was coming into being. And people, it's so hard for people now on the web and everything to go back to that time. There was no internet. You know, there was these wonderful people, Ben Cerf and Bob Kahn and all these people, Bill Joy, who had developed TCP/IP and embodied it in the ARPANET. This was a few computer science departments and military, okay? Nobody in the physics department or chemistry department ever heard of the ARPANET, much less had any access to it. But it was obviously the right idea. And so once we got the Congress to put through money for a national supercomputer program, then there was a national competition and so on, and the five centers were selected. The first thing then the NSF realized, well, okay, now we put these in place to be providing access to academic scientists, and yet, like, they have to fly to Champaign-Urbana, like I had to fly to Livermore, okay? This isn't right. So there were a lot of discussions then, but the trouble was that the telecom lobbyists in Washington would block any discussion of the federal government putting in the kind of network we have today, which is what people wanted. And everybody knew that they wanted to have a ubiquitous email, person-to-person network. But as soon as they'd start talking about that, the telecom lobbyists would come up and say, no way, guys, that's private sector. Don't get the federal government involved in that. Stay out of it. So what we learned early on is real interesting. It's like, if we had argued instead of the supercomputer program, let's get the federal government to buy everybody a personal computer, which was IBM personal computer, was 2 years old in 1985, and put on people's desks, okay? Again, this would be an interference with the private sector. But we said, oh, we'll just take a few of these esoteric supercomputers. And we said, okay, that's right, there's no market there, that's okay. The federal government has a role. Well, the same thing with networking. What we said is, we just want to put a high-speed backbone across the country to connect the five centers. And the telecom people said, okay, that's cool. You know, 56 kilobits was the national high-speed backbone, less than ISDN today. Yeah, that's not a market, okay? And we said, we got a few of these weird supercomputer types who are out in universities who want to hook into that. And say, yeah, that's okay, that's not a market. You can do that. Well, that was the NSF net backbone. Then the regionals got funded, and then the campuses were afraid that if they didn't dig up their quad and put in some fiber, then the professors who wanted to get access to supercomputers would go to a university that would do that. So gradually, the whole internet emerged out of the sort of policy advice you get into Washington, where you can't do the right thing. You have to do something that seems irrelevant, but has a logic to it that will gradually bring the market forces into play that will spin out ultimately a whole industry.
So you get to meet the bad guy in our story, right? The telecommunication lobbyists are the bad guy in our story. So, so of course, Larry's from University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and so the National Science Foundation network was sort of a redo of this ARPANET network that Larry referred to as Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn and all those folks. Let me show you something real quick. And I'll send you the URL on this eventually. I'm currently editing. How many people went to the Dan Atkins thing Monday? Okay. So there was this guy that was up there that kept talking. he was on the first panel, but then he would walk up and do commentary all the time. Okay, and his name was Vint Cerf, and Vint Cerf is credited as one of the co-creators of the TCP/IP and the ARPANET. And we grabbed Vint Cerf and spirited him away for an interview that I'm editing right now that I will share with you when I'm done. So let me just show you the beginning of that interview.
Packet switching was an idea which was specifically studied by Len Hornrock at MIT, who was actually looking at message switching, and he did a brilliant dissertation on the use of queuing theory to analyze what networks of queues would look like using this message switching approach. And his analysis, although he never used the word packet,
He just goes on and on. Like Larry Smarr, actually, that Larry Smarr video was 60 minutes. I pointed the camera at him after the pleasantries at the beginning, and I said, tell me a little bit about NCSA. He never took a breath for 60 minutes. He just talked through for 60 minutes. Similar Vint Cerf.
Times things move around, and you get variable delay and also variable interference. So these were three different packet networks. Then the problem is, how do you put them together? You wouldn't have this problem if you put all the technologies into one net. But if you put them all into one net, it makes it really hard to do control over all these highly variable parameters. So instead, he says, break them into different networks and connect those together. So we designed and built a gateway, which today we call a router. And that concept also introduced a whole bunch of other things, like how do you refer to another network? Each network thinks it's the only network in the universe. This is true of the proprietary networks like SNA and DEC. So 78, we fix everything. It's now, by this time, the internet protocols have split off because people like David Reed and David.
Maybe I'll have that ready for next week. So he just went on again, just like Larry Smarr. As long as we would let him talk, he told the entire history of packets and from 1969 to 1985 without taking a breath. I never interrupted him once. I never asked him another question. I'll show you that next week. And so where that little story that Vint Cerf was telling us about ends is when the NSFNet starts. And so Vint and his crew had sort of created this wonderful technology that then they birthed in the form of the NSFNet, and then it took off in a whole different direction. So the NSFNet was taking this technology, this packet technology, this TCP/IP technology, and putting it into production in the service of science, not in the service of computer science research, but in the service of science and connecting people. And the goal was to connect research universities, as Larry Smarr mentioned. You know, got to get physicists and other folks, but frankly, Larry Smarr had a much broader agenda than that. He just was shielding his real agenda. And so we are now going to go from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign with Larry Smarr to the University of Michigan. So give you a little bit of history. If you look at the ARPANET pictures, you will see that the University of Michigan, which is one of the world's greatest public universities, was not shown on any of those maps. Let me show you real quick. See, the University of Michigan is not on that map. You'd think that's quite an omission. How would one of the world's greatest public universities not be on such a cool map? Turns out that Cleveland is, Case Western Reserve is, because they needed a place physically in between, right? So if they're going to go across, so there's various places that just like they needed to like have a spot. So Case Western Reserve is a great place, and there's a lot of really bright people there. They needed places so that these wires weren't so dang long as they were going from the East Coast, MIT and those groups, and the West Coast, which is like UCLA and Stanford, Berkeley, and all those folks. So now we have University of Michigan, where you'll note that it wasn't on the network. And that's because the University of Michigan, Michigan State University and Wayne State University, had built their own packet switching network. Now, if you go look at the history of the internet, you'll see that this Merit Network, which was the Michigan Education Research Instructional Triad, this Merit Network is credited as the first packet switch network that had as its sole purpose making users' lives better. It was a user-facing network. And the idea was to have researchers to share the software on each other's computers and the computers so we could send statistical jobs back and forth. So University of Michigan had one kind of computer and one kind of statistical software called SAS. East Lansing had statistical software called SPSS. So researchers who wanted to use SAS from East Lansing could send their jobs to Ann Arbor, and researchers who want to use SPSS from Ann Arbor could send their jobs to East Lansing. And then the jobs would come back and print locally, and they would chug across this thing, and this goes back to the thing about if we only had a Ferrari with some tapes in the back, we'd move the data faster. But we had this network. But it was really intended to be end users, and it's really very cultural about this place, not just being an engineering organization, but an engineering and liberal arts organization, to be about people and see how the technology connect information and people. Again, the ultimate school of information thing. So we had this network, and we thought our network was cooler, and we were building routers and building these things and building technology and soldering stuff and doing all the stuff during the same time period as the ARPANET. So we thought we were cooler than the ARPANET. And frankly, who cares, right? The ARPANET was just a research thing. We were doing our thing. We thought we were more cool. But then when it turned into the NSFNet, at that point, it was pretty clear that all these other research things were like done. That was the end of that. People weren't going to invent their own networks anymore. So the University of Michigan, being one of the world's leading public universities, tried very hard to get a supercomputer center because it was a really badge of honor. Illinois got one. Michigan did not. Michigan made a tactical error because the University of Michigan was an IBM shop and everyone else was either a CDC or Cray shop. And the way to get the fastest IBM hardware on the planet was to buy it from Japan. So the folks at the University of Michigan proposed to the federal government that we get $10 million to buy a Japanese computer when everyone else proposed that they would buy an American computer. Not a real wise move. So we didn't get a supercomputer. And frankly, we still hardly have one. We really don't. It's still to this day, this is like 85, 83, 84, 85, we still don't have supercomputing on par with other universities. So Michigan decided, if we lost the battle for the supercomputer, how about we win the battle for the network? Now, interestingly, Michigan was not part of any of the ARPANET schools, so it had no experience in it. So Michigan knew from the beginning that it had almost no chance of winning because it had no experience in TCP/IP. So Michigan decided to cheat, which is the traditional way in these situations. These days, it's standard operating procedure to do what Michigan did, to cheat on high-profile NSF grants by going and getting so much money from somebody else that you present such a great deal. So, Larry Smarr mentioned the lobbyists. The lobbyists knew what this was. It was AT&T, of course. They knew what this was. They knew it was dangerous. They knew it could be whatever. But somebody in Congress forced the hand. Now, some of you may snicker, but I believe, and I believe I will have video to prove this within a few years, that it was Al Gore that basically said to the lobbyists, leave this $15 million alone. So Al Gore did not say, I invented the internet. What? He did not invent the internet. He never said he invented the internet. What he said was, I was instrumental in creating the conditions that led to the internet. And then, of course, because it was a political, they politicized it to... And he still, to this day, is painted with that brush. So somebody in the federal government let this one go because the lobbyists wanted to kill it. But the lobbyists apparently couldn't kill it, so the lobbyists crippled it instead. The lobbyists basically calculated what it would take to make a network and made the budget to the point where the network would only be 56 kilobits across the entire country for 5 years. This is 1985 through 1990, the national backbone, according to the budget that was allowed by the AT&T lobbyists. The AT&T lobbyists didn't want it to happen at all, but they said if it's going to happen, we're going to give it such a crappy budget that it'll be such a piece of crap that it'll never work. So University of Michigan looks at a $15 million budget, and Doug Van Holling, who you'll meet in a moment, he was also there Monday with the Atkins thing. Doug also was part of the interview with Vince Cerf. Doug was running Merit at the time, and Doug knew people from IBM, and he knew people from MCI, and he basically came up with this deal. He called up IBM, said, "Hi, I'm from Michigan. There's this NSFNet thing. IBM, you have no chance. The only way you can be part of this is if you give me the hardware for free and promise to write all the software for free." And everyone goes, "Yeah, Doug, you're a good guy. We'll do that." Then he calls up MCI. He says, "MCI, you're a startup, little startup company. You're trying to become cool. Why don't you get associated with something cool like this? But AT&T is going to win this. But the only way you can be part of this is you have to give it to me for free for 5 years. And you can't go 56 kilobits. You have to go 1.5 megabits instead. But it's got to be free, and then we're going to make it faster than that." And then he went to the state of Michigan and IBM, and he got to the point where he had a budget of about $55 million by the time it was all said and done. And I guess I'll let Doug tell the rest of the story. I just never remember what year I taped these things in. They all, years run together after a while. There we go, Doug.
Industry into this, would the state be interested? And Jamie said, yes, I'll get back to thee once you sort of fit the pieces together. Then we went to the IBM Corporation, because even though IBM, very much like Merit, didn't have a lot of credentials in internet protocol work, they are a big corporation with lots of capability in building communications equipment. I had an old friend who worked for IBM Research by the name of Al Weiss, who's in charge of all of IBM Research's computing facilities. And I called Al and I said, Al, this is a great opportunity, but IBM is not going to be successful here, and I need your help. And so Al sort of rallied some folks from IBM Research, where there actually was work going on in TCP/IP protocols and so forth. And we had another meeting. I managed to drag Hans Werner out to another meeting with IBM. And Hans Werner admitted at the end of that meeting, there are people at IBM that know something about this, and yes, they could be partners. So we got tentatively an agreement from IBM that they would contribute the hardware and the software to create the routing structure for the network. But we still needed the communications facilities. At that time, the CFO at IBM was a gentleman, I think I remember the name correctly, like his last name was Crow. And so through IBM, we went to him, and he had contact with a former IBM employee who is now the network, the chief technical officer, and essentially the chief network operations officer for MCI. His name was Dick Leepaper. So IBM approached Dick Leepaper and asked him if MCI would be interested in providing the communications facilities for this network. Well, as you may recall, at that time MCI was this fledgling organization. Some people had described it really as a law office, trying to create an environment where they could actually offer telecommunications services up against AT&T's lobbying efforts. And they had just been successful in that. They were establishing facilities across the United States. And Dick Leepaver saw this as an opportunity to sort of move MCI into the big time, to be part of this NSFNet proposal. And so we wound up with an agreement that we would file a joint proposal with Merit as the principal organization, in partnership with IBM, who would build all the routing hardware and software, and with MCI, who would provide the nationwide communications facilities. And while we were, then we got Governor Blanchard to commit $1 million a year from state funds in addition. So we wound up being able to submit a proposal to the National Science Foundation, I think for something like $14.7 million, because we knew the season was 15. But in fact, by including all this in-kind activity, it was actually more like a $55 million proposal. And it wasn't designed to be 56 kilowatts. It was designed to start at T1. Or 1.5 megabits, with planned upgrades over the period of the network's life. We subsequently learned that the proposal was received with considerable skepticism by the reviewers of the National Science Foundation, because Merit did not have a strong history in TCP/IP, and IBM was thought of as the enemy of the internet. It was then focused on its own proprietary protocols. And so people really wondered about our technical ability to pull this off. But that review was conducted without reference to the actual funding pattern. And then when the RAPS got pulled off of the amount of resource that was being committed by the partners for this proposal, it immediately went to the top of the list at the NSF. And I think we always had a notion that it could be a big deal. We didn't know for sure. Because from the time we turned this network on in 88 until about 1994, network traffic, the number of hosts on the network, all of those things grew by at the rate of about 15% a month. So this network literally exploded underneath us. We were extremely fortunate that the protocol suite, TCP/IP protocol suite, and the fundamental notions of the network allowed it to grow at that rate. But we had to do a lot of innovation. The border gateway protocols had to be developed to allow multiple networks to interact with one another. And we have to build increasingly more capable routing and communications facilities. When we started the network, we had T1 circuits, but there were no cards or computers that would go at 1.5 megabits. So we actually had to build our initial routers with 300 kilobit cards. And we used the T1 circuits, we subdivided each of them into 300 kilobit. I'm not far enough in the past here, 300 kilobit circuits. And built a mesh network among all of the routers that we put in place. It wasn't for about a year that we were actually IBM was actually to build prototype cards that would go at 1.5 megabits. And when we put those cards in our test network, we discovered they worked just fine. We put them in the production network, the network started failing on us. And we discovered after a very tough period that the folks who had built the T1 hardware for MCI had planned on using certain bit patterns to do diagnosis on the network, and had never anticipated the notion that anybody would ever use a full 1.5 megabits as a single channel. They had always thought it'd be broken up into a set of voice circuits at 64 kilobits each. And so they didn't have any worry about these patterns ever occurring on their network. Well, it turned out that happened with some frequency on the NSFnet, and it took the communication line down when it did. So they had to re-engineer their hardware to undertake this. We actually had to, for a short period of time, put some translation circuits in our routers that actually looked for these bit patterns, took them out, replaced them with something else, and then reinserted them at the other end to make it work over these T1 circuits. So we had a lot of adventures. Around 1990, this network was growing so fast that it was clear that these T1 circuits were not going to enable what we needed to do. So we had to go to the next step, which was DS3, or from 1.5 megabits to 45 megabits, which is a very large step, a 30-fold increase in capacity. And in order to do that, we wound up creating another not-for-profit organization called Advanced Network and Services. Merit was still the principal investigator on the grant, but it subcontracted the development of this new network, this 45-megabit network, to Advanced Network and Services, which was headquartered in Armagh. The NSFnet was the fastest internet network to the end. It finally was decommissioned in 1995. when the Congress decided that the federal government should not be in the business of supporting something that by that time, in their view, should have been become a commercial facility. I'll not ever forget sitting in a House hearing room in the Capitol, next to Mitch Kapoor, some internet, some small internet company startup CEOs who were complaining to the Congress that it was inappropriate for the NSFnet to be funded by the National Science Foundation when they could provide the service as a commercial service. At the very same time they were making that complaint, they were using NSFnet as their backup network to carry traffic when their much less reliable networks failed on a national scale. MCI, of course, turned out to be a major internet service provider, also using the same technology. In a classic innovator's curse moment, IBM, who was at that time the leader in routing technology for internet backbones, managed to decide that they should kill all of the work they had done in developing these routers because it would threaten their proprietary network efforts. It's probably almost single-handedly responsible for the fact that Cisco became the dominant router company in the United States rather than IBM.
So yeah, I mean, IBM basically in the early 90s, IBM basically had the best technology on the planet and decided to kill it, and all the smart people became the founding employees of Cisco. So a lot of the friends that I had back then became early Cisco engineers building early Cisco technology, where in a sense, much like the Bletchley Park earlier, they knew how to do it, they could start over again and create something quite wonderful. So let's see, is there anything else? Maybe we should take a break here. Where are we going next? So here is the early NSFnet backbone, July 1989, and now we see Ann Arbor, of course, is on that. The building in the upper right-hand corner of the picture is where the first NSFnet operation center was, where they had the big screens. How many of you have been in that building, but it used to be called SI North. It's on North Campus. There's that one building that looks like it has portholes in it. This building is right next to it, and that was where I personally walked into that building in 1989 and saw my first live internet connection in that building, and that's where we ran it all from. The first real public internet. Now the NSFnet was initially aimed at research universities, and again there was kind of like this. We pretended that it was all for research, but there were all kinds of situations where it's a good thing that this happened in academia and that we don't follow orders very well and we misbehave and. And so there was all these universities that did sort of technically naughty things that were always pushing the envelope. Cleveland, Case Western Reserve, as I mentioned, had been on the ARPANET. So they had a very active sort of culture there in Cleveland. And they started sort of violating the rules and having like dial-up bulletin boards that then allowed them to get real end users with no accounts on the internet, and there was just kind of this like gentle disregard of the rules that just slowly but surely the people were revolting and refusing to follow the rules, and it, it, it by the early 90s, we started having internet service providers and dial-up and paying. And so what happened was, is this thing just sort of like crept out. It just busted out of its shell. And there was no, once this thing got out and it became infected in the general population, there was no putting it back in. And so a lot of us who were in academia at the time, we like tell everybody like, this is the coolest thing, this is the coolest thing, this is the coolest thing. Here's this number, use this number, dial up, do this stuff. And so there was very much an advocacy about getting this to the point where the rest of the world understood what it was so that it wouldn't go away. So, okay, so let's take a break now. Let's see where we're going next. So we're going to Switzerland next. So let's come back at 20 after, and we will continue our journey and go to Switzerland.